Tensions running high in Israel as protesters rally as part of what they call a day of resistance against dictatorship. Russia confirms firing a wave of missiles against Ukraine, saying that the strikes were performed in retaliation for Kiev's attacks on its border. French Senate ignoring months of protests against the government's pension reforms and votes to raise the retirement age to 64. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. Israeli police have clashed with ralliers during a demonstration against judicial reforms proposed by the far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. Several people were arrested in the demonstration that blocked a major highway to the airport. Protesters had gathered in a public display of anger at Netanyahu's overseas trip. Demonstrators also disrupted a visit by the U.S. Defense Secretary. Protest organizers had called for traffic jams as part of what they called a day of resistance against dictatorship. Many other main intersections were also clogged by protesters. For weeks, the regime has witnessed major rallies against Netanyahu's judicial reforms. Critics argued that illegal changes would encourage corruption and diplomatic isolation for the regime. Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid on the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the killings took place near the flashpoint city of Jenin. The victims have been identified as three young people, aged 26, 25, and 22. Jenin and its surrounding areas have been repeatedly targeted by the regime forces in recent months. The attack on the West Bank has increased since the formation of the regime's right-wing cabinet under Prime Minister Netanyahu. The new deaths bring to 77 the number of people killed by Israeli troops in the occupied territories so far this year. Tel Aviv has been intensifying its atrocities against Palestinians with impunity. Political commentator and activist Mick Napier says that Israel's growing rate of killing Palestinians in the occupied territories is part of the policy of reducing the Palestinian population.
It's noteworthy that the great majority of killings this year have been by the army, relatively few by settlers. So it's still very much an official policy to have this increased rate of killing at the moment. I mean, what can one say? The United Nations Human Rights Council published a report, one of many, many similar reports, and they said that during the Great March of Return, the Israelis were killing women and children and journalists and medical workers, knowing who they were. They were very clear who they were. And this is Israeli policy to kill these categories, but also, of course, to kill anybody who dares to resist. And this army, when they kill Palestinians, and they do kill children quite deliberately, according to the UNHCR and other reporters, when they do this, they know exactly what they're doing. This is an attempt to reduce the number of Palestinians. They use massacres on a huge scale. They use making life unbearable so that many Palestinians will leave and seek refuge somewhere else. But the killing is one way of keeping the numbers down as well.
As the Israeli regime subjects Palestinian prisoners to most extreme human rights violations, people in Gaza have taken to the streets to express their anger at these repressive measures. Ola Al-Asi reports from Gaza.
Tens of Palestinians took to the streets after prayer, expressing their support with the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails against the repressive measures and policies initiated by the far-right Israeli Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir. Thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons continue for the 22nd day of collective disappearance measures in response to the ongoing repression campaign. Islamic Jihad movement has affirmed its support for the Palestinian prisoners' civil disobedience actions in the face of the Israeli fanatic measures, stressing that the prisoners will never be abandoned.
We declare in the Islamic Jihad that we stand with the Palestinian prisoners and support their civil disobedience actions. And even if the measures escalated to an open-ended hunger strike, we will support them and ready for all the possibilities. We will never abandon them.
On top of these measures is the approval of a draft bill that would authorize the execution of the Palestinian detainees that have performed anti-occupation operations. The campaign is expected to culminate on the first day of the upcoming holy fasting month of Ramadan, with a full-scale hunger strike bearing the banner of freedom or martyrdom. Palestinian prisoners' father expressed his concerns over the hunger strike step, calling for the international organizations to support the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners' families live in stress over the lives of their sons and daughters in Israeli jails, as hunger strike is the most difficult thing a prisoner can endure, and it threatens their lives.
Palestinians chanted slogans against the far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and called for the immediate halt of the repressive measures.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip stressed that Israel's hostile policies will never stop them from exercising the right to resist the regime and its settlers. Alal Asif, Gaza.
Iran's foreign minister and his delegation are in Syria, the second leg of a regional tour. Hossein Abdullahian is in Damascus, where he's scheduled to meet with President Bashar al-Assad and his Syrian counterpart. He already visited Latakia, a city in northwestern Syria, worst hit by the deadly February earthquake. The Iranian minister said that the Iranian Red Crescent and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have been providing aid to the Syrian people since the quake first hit the country. Emre Abdullahian visited Turkey before his trip to Syria. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has added a new warship and vessels equipped with the missile launchers to its Navy fleet. In a ceremony in the southern port city of Bandar Abbas, the IRGC unveiled the Shahid Mahdavi warship. It's capable of carrying and operating variant helicopters, drones, and high-speed destroyers. The indigenously built ocean liner is also equipped with missile defense systems and radars. 95 smaller boats added to the fleet can launch missiles with a range of 10 to 180 kilometers. The vessels have been upgraded from rocket launchers to destroyers. They have high maneuverability and can operate in all weather conditions. In the ceremony, IRGC Chief Major General Hossein Salami said that the enemy is present in the region with full force, but he stressed that the more the enemy tries, the less it gains, and it just deviates from its intended goals. Russia has confirmed firing a wave of missiles against Ukraine, saying that the strikes were performed in response to attacks on its border earlier this month.
In response to the March 2nd terrorist actions organized by the Kiev regime in the Bryansk region, Russia's armed forces dealt a massive retaliation strike. High-precision, long-range, air, sea, and land-based weapons, including the hypersonic missile system Kinjal, hit key elements of Ukraine's military infrastructure, military and defense factories, as well as energy facilities, providing resources to these facilities.
Well, Konashenkov said that all the assigned targets were hit. According to Ukrainian officials, four people were killed in the western Lviv region. Key energy infrastructure and residential buildings were also hit in northeastern Kharkiv and southern Odessa. The strikes that started on Wednesday also left 40% of residents in the capital Kiev without power. Moscow accusing Kiev of making a new provocation by cutting out the power supply to the Zaporizhia nuclear plant that's under Russian control. Ukrainian power company has blamed the outage on a Russian missile strike. Moscow rejecting a U.S. media report that a pro-Ukraine group was likely behind last year's attack on the undersea Nord Stream gas pipelines.
As for the pro-Ukrainian angle, you know, the idea that some Dr. Evil organized it, that's hard to believe. It was a too difficult task, which probably only a well-trained special state service was capable of, and there are not too many of them in our world.
The Kremlin spokesman also demanded a quick and transparent investigation into the blasts, adding that Russia must be involved in the investigation. Peskov discarded a U.S. report that Moscow could have orchestrated the attacks. He said those responsible for the, quote, terrorist act must be identified. And Tuesday, the New York Times cited U.S. intelligence authorities as saying that a Ukrainian group might have performed the attack on the pipelines. The report presumed that the saboteurs are most likely Ukrainian or Russian nationals, or a combination of both. Kiev responded by denying any involvement. Russia has been pressing for an international probe since an American investigative journalist alleged that Washington was behind the incidents. Now, in France, senators voted to raise the retirement age to 64 as part of the government's move to reform the existing pension system, despite mounting anger among workers. The conservative-dominated upper house of parliament approved the bill with 201 votes for and 115 against. The move effectively wipes out more than 1,000 amendments made to texts by opponents. Lawmakers have until March 26 to vote on a final draft. Tens of thousands of people have marched in Paris and other cities in recent weeks to denounce the reform. Workers in different sectors, including railways and energy, have also staged strikes for a third consecutive day to heap pressure on the government. After a sixth day of record rallies on Tuesday, trade unions calling for a new day of nationwide demonstration over the weekend. The government is trying to raise their retirement age to 2 years, arguing that the current system is expected to dive into deficit within a decade.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
President Macron's administration is going to raise their retirement age to 64, and they argue that the change is needed thanks to the country's deficits forecast for the next 25 years. Opponents argue that the plan would penalize low-skilled workers who start their careers early while reducing their right to leisure and a long retirement at the end.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions.
The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Born has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
In Georgia, two nights of violent protests have forced the ruling party to drop a bill to classify media and NGOs that receive funding from abroad as foreign agents. The Georgian Dream Party said that it would unconditionally withdraw the bill to reduce conflict in society. Protest rallies began across the nation after lawmakers approved the first reading of the draft law. It would have required all organizations receiving more than 20% of funding from overseas to register or face substantial fines. Protesters feared that the law would be used to harass government critics and clamp down on opposition that would harm the country's chances of European Union membership. President Salome Zurabishvili has also vowed to veto the legislation.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَعِبَرَةً.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 كتاب الله.
Hidden Files.
One 100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations, and not inflicting collective punishment, and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists, they're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing you know, the good and the bad and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S. to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s on a host of different nations like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. de Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impacts of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I make in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter, and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
Well, what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us right here next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Islam will eternally prevail. Part 2.
The enemy targeted this mosque in its recent aggression like they did to the other mosques in the Gaza Strip.
On July 30th, they hit the mosque with unmanned drones that landed on the water tankers. None of the neighbors heard anything, and so did nothing. Then they fired another missile, which made us aware and think they were going to target the mosque, as that was the way the Israeli occupation worked, with unmanned drone missiles firing first.
We went to the balconies and windows immediately to see what was going on. We didn't know that the mosque was the target and the missiles hit the water tankers. They fired another missiles after that. Then people started to scream, urging us and our neighbors to leave our homes. We were unsure as to whether we should leave and risk getting bombed or stay and be exposed to the same risk. It was indescribable, a horrific time.
We had 50 people in our house. I was awake with my family next to me, which includes three boys, two daughters, and my wife. My two brothers and their families were there as well, totaling about 50 people. I woke the boys up and the girls and rushed to my brother upstairs. I can't describe to you how this all happened in just minutes. Those who were sleeping woke up alarmed, and we had to look after the elderly members and those who needed to be carried. Bottom line, we all left the building.
We were separated from each other. I lost three of my kids and had to go back to search for them. We weren't able to grasp what was happening in the moment. Electricity was cut and neighbors were screaming while ambulances rushed injured and firefighting crews raced around. I had to return after receiving a phone call from my neighbors telling me that my kids were at his place. On the way, I was injured, hit by shrapnel in my foot, back and head, and my brother was injured too. We were running, but we couldn't run far, because the missiles came down so fast as we were following one another.
قصف هذا المسجد اثنين صواريخ كما يقولون صواريخ زنانة ثم
This mosque was targeted with two unmanned drone missiles, followed by two F-16 vacuum missiles, as they call them. The F-16 raid was the reason for the collapse of the minaret on the Radwan family's home.
ضربة صواريخ F-16 هي كانت السبب في نزول أو سقوط المئذنة على بيت رضوان.
لما وقعت المئذنة على البيت طبعاً.
The tip of the minaret that collapsed onto the house weighed 10 tons. It flew about 8 meters onto the roof. It was Allah's mercy that prevented it from falling on the neighbors. Otherwise, none of them would have survived. The main body of the minaret broke 3 to 4 roofs due to its heavy weight.
كان في هناك شهداء من جراء القصف رجل مسن
There were some martyrs as a result of the bombardment. An old man died and a pregnant woman from the Radwan family died also.
My sister-in-law was 6 months pregnant. She miscarried on the spot due to the explosion. They sprayed missiles over the Palestinian people to the extent that shrapnel, sand and small stones reached as far as 500 meters.
There were 20 to 30 injuries suffered by people in nearby houses due to the impact of stones and glass flying.
Al-Sosi worshippers refused to be distracted from performing their prayers near the mosque and so set up a makeshift mosque on a vacant land beside the original location, only to see it bombed also. Israeli aircraft did not give them the opportunity to pray.
وفعلا بدأنا بنصب الحديد وتجهيز المصلى وكان
We started preparing a makeshift mosque the very next day. An organization provided us with the shading to finish it. We were shocked the next night to be hit by another bombardment targeting the area. We rushed to the area to find they targeted the exact spot we were preparing to build a makeshift
mosque.
The town of Huzar in the south, with a population of 9,000, suffered immense damage after it was heavily bombarded for 3 days by the Israeli regime, to the degree that the town was almost completely wiped out. 7 mosques out of 9 were destroyed, the most prominent being the township center mosque, Jamaat Ibad al-Rahman. After the annihilation, Israeli forces besieged the town for 10 days, cutting it off from the outside world. A Red Cross worker described the scene as a tsunami of death.
Unfortunately, they sabotaged the infrastructure and the structures. The whole electricity network in Al-Najjar neighborhood and entire city in Huzar was destroyed. It was intentionally leveled by bulldozers. They removed the pylons, wires, water networks, and everything. They even leveled 7 mosques and blew them up with dynamite.
They are taking out their anger on the mosques. We don't know why they're doing this to mosques. They target people, mosques, houses, and everything around the mosque. All surrounding houses were destroyed. I live next to the mosque, but no one passes by or greets me now. I am so affected by this.
Northern Gaza also suffered extensive destruction of its mosques. One example was the beautiful Omar Abdul Aziz Mosque in Beit Hanan, important to Muslims worldwide and renovated by a Malaysian Islamic organization in 2013, was bombed to smithereens for the second time in its history by an Israeli airstrike. Rubble and a pile of concrete remain.
They targeted this mosque in every war. This is the second time now. The first building was bigger than this. It was 3 or 4 floors high, but it was targeted too. The Omar Mosque that we built was targeted as well. If they had destroyed my house, it would be much easier for me to bear. I have a great affection for this mosque that Allah only knows. The mosque is my whole life, as I attended there 1 or 2 hours before the call for prayer to recite the Quran and help clean the mosque. A whole life revolves around the mosque.
يعني حياتنا كلها في المسجد احنا الاحتلال الاسرائيلي يفرغ حقده.
The Israeli occupation demonstrates its hatred on houses of the Lord. Destroyed mosques were found to have no weapons or resistance in them. We at the Ministry of Waqf supervise the mosques. We challenge the occupiers to present one piece of evidence that mosques were being targeted because of the Palestinian resistance or any resistance that acts whatsoever. They are places for worshipping only.
هي بيوت للعبادة وفقط.
The Palestinians did not quit or give up as their holy places fell. They immediately went to work to construct temporary mosques and places for prayer. And whilst these hastily built sanctities provided little protection from the weather, it brought the people together for each call to prayer.
We set up structures to pray under while the rainfall was dripping on us. Praise the Lord that we are steadfast and that we will survive on this soil. No matter what the Zionists do, we will prevail and reform.
This mosque was built by residents of the neighborhood and from other good doers. We built a mosque inside the refugee camp in an area that was designated to be a park. We used material from greenhouses to build the mosque and we pray there.
عملنا المسجد وهلا بنصلي فيه ناس ملتزمين بالدين فقولوا لنا لازم نعمل مسجد اللي نقدر نصلي الصلوات فيه يعني ايش تأدية الفريضة لله سبحانه وتعالى.
We decided to build a makeshift mosque because people here are devoted to their religion. We agreed we should build the mosque to perform rituals of the Lord and decided to make the mosque out of material from greenhouses. You can see those two where people used to fill the mosques before it was targeted. Now there are barely 3 lines in this small mosque. The houses of most of the neighbors were reduced to rubble and they left the area to rent elsewhere.
كلهم راحوا من البلد وفي اخذوا تاجروا في مناطق ثانيه الاحتلال يقصد من كثرة استهداف.
Israelis target Palestinian mosques repeatedly. 27% of mosques along the Gaza Strip are either completely or partially damaged. It is their intention to subjugate the Arab and Muslim people. It is also to pave the way for the tearing down of the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque to be replaced by a Jewish temple.
اتجاه المسجد الأقصى المبارك إنه
قدام. It's like they're telling people not to be shocked if the Al-Aqsa Mosque is destroyed, just like any other mosque that was destroyed in the Gaza War. That's what they want. But Al-Aqsa is different. If it was destroyed, all Muslims around the world under God's will would rain down on Israel. But the Lord will protect it with all its might.
The Palestinian people believe that the Lord protects His house. They believe that the mosques and indeed Islam will eternally prevail despite all efforts by its enemies to destroy them.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.